As I was completely on top of the slides, and I have now reactivated the recording, let's go back and decide, how do we set up our two hypotheses when we're testing for evidence of a linear relationship between two quantitative variables? The research hypothesis that we have, the thing that we think might possibly happen, has to specify the following information. You have to name the variables involved. You have to indicate whether you think there's a positive or a negative linear relationship. You have to link it back to the population of interest that you're studying. And it gives you a really nice generic formula that you can use, or a generic writing that you can use. That no, get rid of that. It should be, there is a positive or a negative linear relationship between one variable and the other variable in whatever population you name, represented by the sample that you've collected. Okay, so just get rid of that no. Now, according to inferential statistics, I start with the opposite of that prediction and try to show that it's wrong. I try to show that the probability that that relationship is zero is so small that I have to reject that idea that the relationship doesn't exist, and rather assume that it does exist. So, in the null hypothesis, which is what I'm starting with, I do the same thing. I specify the variables, but I say that no linear relationship is predicted within the population that you're studying. And so the null hypothesis is always, my R statistic shows no relationship. So what will it be? My R is equal to what value?
Zero.
So your null hypothesis is R is equal to zero. Your research hypothesis is R is whatever. Greater than if you think it's a positive linear trend, less than if you think it's a negative correlation. Ready for practice. For each of the following, show the envelope for the null hypothesis and the research hypothesis. Now, the envelope for the research hypothesis is always going to be different, but what's the envelope going to look like for the null? What's the shape of the envelope going to be for every null hypothesis? It's going to be a circle. Good. All right. People who have more depression before therapy will be those who have more depression after therapy. So we know that the envelope for the null hypothesis is going to be pretty circular. What's our research hypothesis envelope going to look like? Is it going to be rising to the right or falling to the right? Good. It's going to be some sort of elliptical looking thing that is rising to the right. Everybody good? So again, those who study more have fewer errors. Null hypothesis, going to look the same, still a circle. Those who study more have fewer errors. Which way is this envelope going to trend? Is it going to fall to the right or rise to the right? Good. Performance isn't related to practice. Null hypothesis, circular. Research hypothesis. Good. They should overlap, and they do. Good. Everybody okay?
Why are you saying with the null hypothesis the performance is related to practice?
If you are trying to run the R statistic, there are times when you want to say, I don't think this relationship is real. And so, in fact, you still start with the HO always being that non-relationship. Because R always looks for a linear relationship. The null hypothesis always assumes there isn't one. What you're doing differently is you're going to say, I don't think there's still a relationship, so my research hypothesis is going to match it. Okay. The default for the null is almost always going to be the same. R equals, not almost always, is going to be R equals zero because of the nature of the inferential statistic that you're running. Okay. Good? Okay. Here we go. For each of the following, didn't we just do this? Is this another one? People who score better on the pretest will be those who tend to score worse on the post-test. Null hypothesis. Circular. What's the ellipse going to look like? Is it going to rise or fall? It's going to fall to the right. There we go. You can't predict depression from the number of therapy sessions. Null hypothesis. What's the research hypothesis going to look like? Good. I predict that larger turtles will eat more crickets. Fall or rise? Good. Upward towards the right. Everybody good? Good. Now, what are the decisions that you make? When you retain the null hypothesis, You're concluding what you stated in the null hypothesis. When you run the R statistic, it comes back out and you decide that based on what you're seeing in your sample, there is not a strong enough relationship to conclude there is in fact a linear relationship in the data that you see when you try to generalize it to the population, as is indicated in the sample that you have. So for this particular sample, I did not find a linear relationship. When you reject the null hypothesis, you're concluding that the linear relationship is strong enough to allow me to attempt to predict there's a linear relationship in the population based on what my sample suggests. So when you retain H sub naught, there is no relationship. When you reject it, there is a relationship between those two variables. This is just a little bit of preview for what you're going to have to do and how you make those decisions of accepting or rejecting. If you're computing the R by hand, you're going to run through those algebraic steps to come up with an R value. Then you're going to go to a table that has critical R values in it, and you're going to compare the absolute value of your answer, so ignore the sign, to the critical value that you looked up in the table. If your computed R's absolute value is smaller than the critical, you're going to retain H sub naught. You didn't get a strong enough correlational value that exceeds the critical, so you're going to hold on to H naught. Do you know what I mean when I say that? You hold on to the null hypothesis. I'm sorry. When I say H naught, I'm referring to the little zero, which stands for null hypothesis. I apologize that I keep saying that. I don't think Cal uses that word. If I calculate the R, and the absolute value of that R value is greater than the critical that I looked up on the table, I reject the null hypothesis and then conclude that there is a linear relationship. When you calculate this on the computer is going to crank out the R for you. You can also calculate the p-value. If the p-value that you get is greater than 0.05, we conclude that that relationship is not strong enough and we're going to retain the null hypothesis. If p is less than 0.05, again, just like with every other p less than 0.05 that you've learned about, you're going to reject the null hypothesis and in fact conclude that there is a linear relationship. Okay. So we're going to look at how we would predict whether or not we have a significant relationship or not. We have a research hypothesis that younger adolescents would be more polite than older adolescents. A sample of 84 adolescents were asked their age and to complete the politeness quotient questionnaire. Is a Pearson R appropriate here? What do we have to have in order to decide we're going to run a statistic that is an R value? Two, what kind of variables? We have two quantitative variables. So age, yep, that's quantitative. And it looks like the survey that they answer is probably also going to be a quantitative value. When we do the calculation by hand, the R that we get is negative 0.453. The critical value on the table is 0.254. Are we going to retain or reject the null? Yep, we're going to reject it. Did we find support for the research hypothesis? Assuming that we did a scatter plot and it looked like an envelope that was kind of elliptical and not quadratic. Did we find support for our research hypothesis? Yep, we did. So that would be an example of a correct decision. Now let's look at the same kind of example, but by doing a computation in a computer. We have a research hypothesis that older professors take more naps. Oh, no, not more naps. Older professors receive lower student course evaluations. A sample of 124 intro to psych students from 12 different sections completed the student evaluation. Professors' ages were obtained with permission from their files. The R that I got was negative 0.352. My p-value is 0.431. Accept or reject the null. Sorry, retain or reject the null. Good, I'm going to retain it. Is there support for the research hypothesis in this sample? Nope. There is not a linear relationship. Maybe the data are quadratic. If you didn't do the scatter plot, you would not know. But from this R statistic, is the value, even though it seems kind of big, especially in psychology research, 0.352, a lot of us like do backflips and we're like, publish! But there must be something going on with that data that caused that p-value to come out quite high. So we're going to learn what questions to ask. And I think maybe two more weeks when you get a result where you're like, well, shit, this looks good, but the p-value says otherwise. There's some questions that we need to ask for follow-up about the nature of that data. I'm not talking about that with you today, though. So now, from the last class, we learned that when we make decisions, remember, we can't ever know what the data look like in the population because that's why we have a sample. At our best, we can go and consult the literature who did very similar studies to us and see what kind of linear relationship they pulled out. But the reality is every time we run a correlation, because there are typically three types of outcomes you can get with correlation, positive relationship, negative relationship, or zero relationship, you can tend to make more goofs. But the good news is that the goofs have the same name, the same type of problems that we talked about in the last lesson. So we still have type one errors, but now we have two chances to make type one errors. We still have type 2 errors, but we have two opportunities. We still have misspecifications. We have two opportunities, and we can get it right three times because, again, positive, negative, and zero correlation. So, again, let's have a look. In the population, we actually have a negative correlation. We decided we have a negative correlation. Is that correct or incorrect? That's correct. In the population, we have a negative correlation. Our statistics showed a zero correlation. So there is a relationship out there. We found that there wasn't one. Type two. You good? We missed the fact that there is a significant relationship in the population because our data indicated the correlation was zero. In the population, again, we have a negative correlation. We crank out our data, and woohoo, we got a positive correlation. Are we happy? No. That's why, again, we got to go and consult the literature. So if the population says the relationship is negative, a negative correlation, we find a positive correlation, we've goofed, but we've made one of those misspecification type 3 errors. So again, in the population, now there is no relationship. So if we run our statistics and we find a relationship, we've made two kinds of false alarms. Ah! So if in the population the correlation is zero and I say, nope, p less than 0.05 told me that my sample has a negative linear relationship, I've goofed, I've made a false alarm. I say there is a relationship, it happens to be negative in this case, when the population says there is no relationship. If the population said there's no relationship and I find there's no relationship, that's a correct retention of my null hypothesis. Lastly, if there is no relationship in the population but I find a relationship, I've still screwed up, but in this case I've screwed up because I said there is a positive correlation. That's a false alarm. There is no relationship, and I say that there was. Same thing for positive correlation in the population. Everybody good? Do you need me to go through this again, or is this like making your eyes bleed? Okay, just make sure that you can interpret. So we still have type 1, type 2, type 3 errors. We still have correct rejections, or we still have correct retentions, okay? That little line at the bottom. We never know what's in the population. Our best chance is once we find a result to make sure that we're aware of what most of the literature suggests about the nature of that result. If they align, we're pretty confident in our answers. If they don't align, we have to, again, ask some more questions about the data that we have. That's in 2 weeks. Back to causal interpretability. When somebody says they've run a correlational analysis, especially based on how we talk about correlations in intro to psych, when you get an R value, it's kind of automatically assumed that, well, people were probably using natural groups if they're getting measurements from these people. So there couldn't have been an experiment that was conducted. So there's no way that we could assume causal interpretability. But remember, doing a correlation is a statistic that is run. Deciding if you have causal interpretability comes from looking at the research design. So we're talking about two different points in that research loop that we learned about in Unit 1. When we're trying to assess causal interpretability, we don't ask what was the statistic that was run. We ask the same question that we asked in Unit 1. Was there a true experiment? And did we have no confounds? How do we know if we have a true experiment? Random assignment. I'm not going to make you say it again. But those are the questions that you have to ask yourself. Do not get lured in by the statistic that was run. When you're trying to decide causal interpretability, you have to go back and look at the method that was employed. And if there is a true experiment with no evidence of confounds, That's the information that you rely upon to decide if there's causal interpretability. When we look at a Pearson's R, I actually asked Cal last night, I was like, okay, but we learned there's only four research designs. We learned between groups, experiment, between groups, non-experiment, within groups, experiment, within groups, non-experiment. I was like, what the hell's a correlation? And if you think about it, if you do have the ability to randomly assign those two values that you have, those two quantitative variables, what he says we often do is we'll pick a value on X, and then we'll pick another value on X and try to show what the relationship is with Y. So instead of looking at the whole infinite number on the X line, we start to segment it up and then run different tests. So he would tell us that correlational kinds of studies can run statistics and can be set up so that we do group level analyses, so that we can have a between groups research design. So even though the statistic that was run was a Pearson R, if the design is between groups and it's a true experiment, we can not only run an R, but we can get other types of statistical analyses out of it as well. That's just a little bit of a prelude when you're trying to read. I'm thinking about this for the Unit 2 test. If he asks you for the research design and all you see is an R, you got to go back and figure out, is it between or within? For the most part, it's between groups analyses that you can do. Okay, when we start talking about the computation, you have to do a hand computation again for this assignment. Just please keep in mind the process that's involved. So you have one column that has your X values. You have one column that has your Y values. So in the very first example, we have one column that depicts the age of the puppy, and we have one column that depicts how many pounds of food the puppy eats. And then you have to go through that process of squaring each individual X value, and then you have to also square each individual Y value. You add up both of those columns to get the sum of X, the sum of X squares. But then you also have to get the sum of X Ys. So that means you have to first multiply your X value by your Y value, get a column of all of those values, and add them up at the end. Once you make all of those individual hand calculations, you then can go back and begin to do the rest of the hand calculation for that correlation. So just make sure you keep all of those columns straight. You only start with the X and the Y. You got to create those other three yourself. Remember that when we're doing the sum of the X squared, because there's no parentheses around it, you do what you're supposed to do according to PEMDAS or whatever little acronym you learned about. You get the X squared value first, and then you summate all of those X values to get the sum of the X squareds. Good? So when you see sigma X, it's just all the column of X's that you add up. When you see sigma X squared, you have to square the individual X's first and then add them all up. When you get the sum of X Y's, you have to multiply the X value with its corresponding Y value, make a column of all of those, and sum it up. The one calculation or the one number that you have to pull out yet that we didn't talk about is the N. The N is the size of your sample. So from our very first study, we had 17 puppies. Even though we have 34 pieces of information, the pair that you get of XY depicts one in the sample, all right? One puppy gave me two pieces of information, but it was still only one puppy. So the N is the number of participants that you get data from. And then you also have to calculate degrees of freedom, and it's a particular formula that you follow for the R, and that's also in your handout. So you just have to remember, what's the size of the sample, and then what do I have to do to it in order to get the degrees of freedom? So what you have left to do is there are some pink things that you have to look at. There's a hand calculation that you have to look at, and I think there's SPSS output that you have to look at for the weekend. Cal is going to be awake from his nap, and he will do chi-square analyses with you on Monday. Y'all have a good weekend. Oh, no! Y'all!